This is Authors in Focus.
Hi, I'm James Reed, a fantasy author publishing under JMD Reed. Mask of Guilt, Mask of Illumination Book 1 is out. We all wear masks, some of us to hide our guilt. Lady Finari, lost in the malaise of depression, finds purpose with a group of all-women thieves, the Crack Gems. Intrigue, romance, betrayal, and adventure swirls around her in this epic fantasy tale. Today, I'm joined by Catherine E. Weibel. She's the author of the mythological fantasy novel The Guardian Speaker, Volume 1.
How are you doing today, Catherine?
Hi, I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm okay, considering I didn't really sleep last night. So.
Oh, no.
I'm a little tired. I think I'm going to take a nap today.
Hey, I understand that.
So, I always like to start these interviews off with a fun question or two. So, Catherine, who is your favorite author?
Okay, so that's a tough question because my favorite type of genre is actually ancient epic poems, poetry and prose. So most of those aren't associated with a particular author. I mean, there's Homer and the Odyssey, but outside of that, a lot of them don't have designated authors. If I had to pick an author, depends on my mood, I guess the little more modern ones, I would have to say Tolkien's probably up top just because I was really have been influenced and appreciate the way he went to source mythology and incorporated it into his works. And that's kind of some stuff that interests me and mine.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely inspired by, you know, the bardic stories of the Saxons and the Norse. And I mean, a lot of the names in The Hobbit are out of like a poem, like Gandalf and all the dwarves all come from the same poem, I believe.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, because Gandalf just means what? Great elf?
Staff elf,
okay. We don't really know because they're oral traditions, right? Those poems that, like, what the King of Iceland wrote down, they could have been, you know, passed on for like 2,000 years and, you know, almost unchanging, you know, because the sort of, I just watched a podcast the other day about, you know, Proto-Indo-European and how like the sort of poetry of a language can exist in its like archaic form as the actual like language changes and stuff. And so like you know, we even have it in English with like the term death do us part, you know, in our wedding vows, which is not something you would ever say in modern English, but yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. So it's like they're like kind of windows into the past, that especially because, you know, not a lot of that stuff got written down until, like, you know, Christian monks and the King of Iceland and all that. It was all oral until then, so.
Yeah, and of course, at that point, all the monks would Christianize
everything. Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to realize what would be the original myth and what is a variant of what was.
Right, called. You have to, like, decrease. Well, I mean, there's not just that. Because, like, I mean, the Romans did that with, like, myths. They would like Romanize them, and you know, like the Troy stuff where they like, yeah, no, Troy is they're our ancestors, we're taking Troy, no, making it ours. Yeah, that's just something cultures do, but it's quite a lot of fun, interesting stuff about that. And that's what you used for the sort of the basis for your book, right? The Guardian Speaker.
Yes, The Guardian Speaker is my adult novella series, and it is heavily influenced. It actually set in Nordic myth and Nordic mythology. So it deals with Yggdrasil and the Nine Realms. So readers will eventually get to see a little bit of all those worlds from Nordic myth as the series progresses. But I am definitely heavily influenced by Nordic myth in this particular series.
Nice. Yeah, that's so there's going to be some world hopping.
Oh yes,
that should be fun. I have an urban fantasy series that I put on the shelf years ago, but which is why I researched into Norse mythology, and I did that. I had like you know, like you could go to different worlds, and they were kind of like overlapping kind of idea where like it was kind of like, you know, you could go to Jotunheim and it'd be like huge mountains and primeval forests, and it's still, and you're, if you move around in it and come back to our world, you'll just have moved around that same sort of distance. But it's like a completely different place or whatever.
But, yeah, mine, again, based off the Nordic myth, I had to like figure out where, like what their visual location was in and among Yggdrasil, the world tree. So which ones obviously were in the boughs in myth and which ones are at different heights and how they interconnected, yeah, where their positioning was. Lots of diagrams, lots of source material open and pinned to different pages to create this universe.
Yeah, I know, because I think I put Midgard kind of like at the base of the tree, and then you have like the stuff down the roots, like would be like, mm-hmm, Niflheim, and there's some other place I would put down there. Place Helheim, I think. Yeah, Helheim or something like that. I don't actually remember which, because there's like, it's the nine realms, but they have more than nine.
Yes, that got complicated, and so I had to like try to explain that. So I kind of merged two, but had like a explanation where one's the world name and the other one is everything that exists below ground. So I kind of was able to explain away there's only nine realms, but there is a definitely distinction between the upper and the lower of one of those worlds.
Yeah, and then there's also like the concept of like Utengard, you know, the outer world, and then that's out beyond Midgard, and I'm not exactly sure how that fits in with the idea of like the nine realms. But I mean, that's what you find in mythology is like, I mean, there's like two Aphrodites if you dig into Greek, really, you know. Yes. And so, you know, people had their like, you know, they had their own like little things going on. They were kind of related to each other. And then now we're here like thousands of years later wanting to make it all like be a seamless whole thing when, you know, it's really like all these little tribes had their own versions, you know, prioritize different things. And
exactly true. And that's why if you read different sagas and epics from the North Myths, you'll read very similar stories, but some have different subplots going on. Others had different characters doing the same thing. And then certain subsections would have their own story just in and among themselves. But again, it's because they were sub-tribes. They weren't a unified Scandinavia as we think today. They viewed themselves as separate kingdoms and separate groups. So their myths evolved separately as well.
Yeah. So tell us about it. It's about Lif, right, who has a strange gift. And she also doesn't like to go on boats and sailing, which that's a lot of their culture, because they were mostly coastal up in, like, Scandinavia, you know, living around the fjords and stuff.
I wrote this series because, well, I've always been interested in mythology, especially the Nordic lore. I was trying to... I always wanted to incorporate that as a series, but was inspired to actually write this one when I did, because I was reading a book pertaining to the belief system of the people during the Viking era, and they were describing how the people back then, that region, believed that there were four parts of self. So each person had hammer, which is your physical body, hugr, which was your mind and soul kind of combined, Ugia, which are your guardian spirits, but they take animal forms and they're invisible, and then Hamingja, which are your personal luck that takes a all-female form as well, and again, invisible female entity that clings to you throughout your life, but every person has all four parts. And that kind of intrigued me, because I always like animals and incorporating animal lore in my writing. So when I heard about the Fugia concept, these animal guardian spirits, kind of like really fascinated and was wondering why I never read anything about them before and like fantasy, and paused there for a second, realized, oh,
that's
I write that.
That's an interesting.
My next project. So that kind of got that the wheel rolling, so to speak, and got me inspired to start actually writing the series.
Yeah, that's a really interesting book, because like I had come across that when I did my research for this urban fantasy novel, and it was really hard for me to find any real good information about these sort of animal guardians, other mm-hmm. than the, like, I mean, even in like, I have like a dictionary, like a pretty like scholarly dictionary of like Nordic terms, and it barely had anything on them in there. It was just like, yeah, they're like animal spirits. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, and the guardians, and I was like, oh, cool. I mean, that's cool. It worked for me. I gave my guy a dog, right?
Mm-hmm.
I made it the spirit of his like dead brother, so like it would be like a reveal or whatever, you know, as sort of like him looking out of it, you know, for him. But it was like I couldn't find much about it, so that's really fascinating.
Yeah, the
kind of hear this.
I was having trouble too, but what I did find out, I guess, was that every person's animal spirit only takes one animal form that solidifies at birth. There's actually, it's like almost gruesome, but I guess most Nordic mythos is, where there's a ceremony where when a child's born, the afterbirth would be put outside because you would be calling in your fusia, which would consume it, and that's why most fusia were carnivorous creatures. But your personality was reflected in the animal. So if you had a bear, you had royal blood. If your fulgio was a wolf, you'd be a good warrior, et cetera, so on. So that's kind of what I played with. But my character, Leaf, she is born with the gift to actually see and communicate with every person's fulgio. And because of this, she actually grew up being shunned almost by her society because they see her as view her as kind of mad because she's a woman who talks to herself because they can't see these creatures. She does. And so she's very off-standish. She's very shy, mild. Her fulgia's form is a squirrel. So a very, you know, just a moderate kind of entity. And the story kind of kicks off when she ends up crossing paths with another person that has a similar ability. He can see Hamingjer, which are the, again, the, everybody's luck, which comes down family lines. And so she kind of bumps into this other person, and he's bringing in a warning saying there's this plague affecting Hamingja. And again, if part of yourself dies, the person will die as well. So in sum, this plague will soon destroy all humanity, and he's the only one who can stop it because he's the only one that can see what's happening. Unfortunately, he's brought in as a slave. So,
yeah, a thrall, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds like a really fascinating book. So, so Leaf has this, so she's got like her sort of her goal. Is there any like antagonist that's kind of like trying to stop her? Any other
in this series, it's not really a big evil per se. It's, you know, the crunch on time to try to figure out what's happening. There's a lot of small, minor, I guess you could say, antagonist, because Leaf has to decide if she's going to free the slave. It's not hers, the thrall. And in doing so, creates enemies who are trying to stop the process of this man trying to find the source of this blight. And because of that, you know, in the end, as the series progresses, they end up leaving Midgard, the world of man, and having to progress through some of the other realms to try to find the answer. And then through those other realms, you'll see other entities, obviously the Jotunheim, the Jotuns, that are, you know, again, very antagonistic to humanity and other entities as well.
Yeah, they're a fun one. Like, everyone calls them giants, but they were like, but that's not actually what the name means.
No.
It means devourer, I believe.
You might be correct. I can't remember exactly, but yeah, they weren't. And many of them don't even describe them as very tall, so they weren't
big,
bulking entities. Same thing with what we perceive as dwarves, the Vgar, they weren't necessarily short.
Yeah, well, it's even like the Titans in Greek mythology weren't giants, but modern English has associated like Titans with the word giant. And then when I think the English, you know, monks were translating stuff, they were like, yeah, we're going to use giant because that's kind of what we use for these sort of entities. And so it kind of got stuck in like the English sphere that, you know, Jotuns are big, huge things, but they're usually like, you know, regular sized people.
Yep. Moderate size, maybe slightly tall, but nothing taller necessarily than one of the gods. And they're only described as maybe slightly tall.
Yeah. I mean, maybe Ymir was, or I don't know if that's
okay, yes,
because they made the world out of him. So he might've been
a little big.
it really sounds like a great idea. So where did you get the idea to sort of tell Leaf's story?
Interestingly, I, again, reading all these sagas, found this obscure line referencing a couple characters that really only played a very minor part in this big epic saga. And so I wanted to, utilizing Leaf, tell that story of those odd characters. So as the story unveils, it will tie into a larger Nordic saga, but you have to read to find out more about that. But that's kind of how I was like, well, I want to approach this very well, respectively well-known epic, but coming from like the most obscure characters.
Fair enough. Yeah. So, how did you go about writing it? Are you kind of like a pantser or a plotter?
This one, again, because I know the overarching mythos that I'm trying to incorporate, the stories, the plot line, the main points are kind of already set for me. And the same thing with like the descriptors. I'm trying to keep it as true to form to what the lore says. So when I come to describe these entities, you know, I'm doing a lot of research based to try to keep it, again, true to form with writing. So this is a little different approach than I've done in the past, because a lot of it is already plotted out in the sense. The detailing is where it gets fun, and, you know, the variance that I'm trying to play with is where it gets fun. But I'm definitely a person where I like to know the end game. I like to know the main points, the main subpoints, the main characters before I start writing. And then any of the other things that come about during writing, that's just fun.
All right. Yeah, that sounds pretty like an interesting way to go about it. Because I find I have a hard time knowing how I'm going to end series. Like, I'm like, yeah, I have this idea for 12 books, and it's going to get to an ending out there somewhere. I'm not sure what that is. I'm going to have to find it as I go on this journey with my characters. So, I know what they want to accomplish, and I know, like, what my bad guys are all about. But I'm like, I'm not really sure how this gets resolved. And I'm going to have to write it to find, like, the tools, you know, to solve this problem. That tends to how I write. Like, I like to plant seeds and then, you know, grow those seeds into the ending. You know,
I want to challenge myself more to do something a little more on those lines. But so far, I just automatically, when the story comes to me, it comes to me in full. And I'm like, well, I already know the end. You know, it's just the little details and the flourishes that need to be written in between.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. No, I get that. I have trouble really saying like the endings to my stories. And not like the ending to a book, but like to a series. I really have a trouble with that. When I write a book, I know how I want to end it. I don't go into writing a book going, but like, yeah, no, the, like, I mean, I've written out series outlines, what I think will happen. And like, I'm off my series outline, but book three, and book four and five, you know, book three, four and five are nothing like how I thought they would be. Like there's stuff that isn't happening. There's characters that like never, that I thought I might utilize that never show up in the story or whatever.
I know that makes it fun. It makes it not boring for the author for sure, because you never know what's gonna happen. So.
Yeah, that's true. Like, I don't know like what things I'm setting up. Like, I remember my first series. I wrote this thing in book two, and it turned out to be the solution to the ending. And I didn't know that when I wrote it in book two. I was just expanding on the world building to kind of show off a part of the magic system that I wanted to expand on. This sort of more esoteric part of the magic system. Now, it's going to be more important to sort of some of the resolution, but I was going to show it off using this artifact. But then as I kind of was getting into the end, I was like, man, that artifact is exactly kind of what I need to like resolve this situation. So I'm like, yeah, no, I didn't just pluck that out. And then people be like, oh, he set that up in book two. Like he knew what he was doing. And I'm like, yeah, no, it's being an author has dispelled a lot of illusions I've had about reading books. We're thinking like maybe the author set things up really early, or maybe they're just really good at remembering things they put in earlier parts of the story and figuring out ways to use them in later parts that make it seem like it was all planned.
I have done the roundabout way where, because I write far faster than I edit, that, you know, when I'm publishing one book, I'm three or four ahead in a series or more. And the fortunate part is that if at book eight, let's say, and I figure something out and I was like, oh, I need to kind of intersperse this earlier, I'm still in the editing process for earlier books, so I can go back and kind of tuck it in there before they publish. And then I'm like, yeah, I planned that from the get-go.
Yeah, no, I do that
exactly
too.
Exactly what I meant.
I'm writing book eight right now, and I just finished editing book two. Like, I just sent it off to my editor yesterday. So I definitely added stuff in books one and two that were set up for things like in books five and six and seven and eight. Although now I'll wait. Once I got through book six, the halfway point, I really had to write out a roadmap. So I had these are the goals I need to get done to get to the ending. And so I was figured out like which book will have each of those. And that's like, all right. So I kind of have a roadmap now, more so because I know how the ending has to be now. mm-hmm. even though I'm still books out because just how this series is going. And so it's a very much a travel series. So a lot of the book is just going to crazy places.
I love that. You know, again, that's kind of like the Guardian Speaker. It's just fun because I really wanted to expose readers, especially people who may not know of this Nordic lore, to like see all these places. And I'm like, well, how can I get them here, but make sense for like the whole plot line? And how can I get them over here and still, you know, get them towards the end goal? So, but I like traveling series.
Yeah, like one of the first fantasy series I've read was the Vilgariad, and that's, you know, there's a map in book one, and by book five they go to every place on that map.
Wow.
And it's a continent map, right?
Yeah.
You know, so there's like it's like 10 different countries on there or something like that, and they go to all of them. Like he gets his character to every single place, not like every place, but like every like country, and there's plot stuff happens in like every country in this book.
That's
in this series. Over the course of five books. So yeah, and it's a quest series, right? They're, you know, they're on a quest, well, at least kind of in the beginning, but book four is kind of not, the quest is kind of done, and then they're dealing with like what the quest was all about. But yeah, it was like, so I wanted to write that. So my characters have been meandering across the world for 8 books now. we're kind of kicking into the end game now where they're going to have to start like, you know, being more proactive, and a lot of it is like them fleeing, you know, that people who are chasing them. So like, but now they're powering up, right? So now they're able to fight back, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So that's also the other fun of the series, you know. Yes. So what are you working on next?
Well, I'm currently trying to put out 2 series at once. So I'm actually releasing the third book of the Guardian Speaker next Friday. And so I'm still working on that series. I'm actually have written 9 of those. Again, different stages of editing for most of them. And then the other series that I have is the Jed Chronicles, which starts with the 12 Tasks. And that's a young adult, just adventure fantasy series. It's one that I was exploring, exposing people to as many different entities and creatures from all sorts of mythology as I could in one book series. So I'm actually working on editing the second one of that to release later this year, crossing fingers, and writing the fourth of that one.
Fair enough. One question.
Yes. What,
is there any significance in the rune that you put on the covers of each of the books in this series? Because you have like you have different runes. I saw. There's like, or is that? Not true.
Yes and no. There's probably people are going to probably find more significance than I intended for that. Originally, I was trying to bounce around, trying to figure out how many books I could write in the series because I know a lot of the storylines, but I wasn't sure how quickly they would break up. So there are 2 alphabets associated with Norse mythology, and the younger Firthark is 16 letters. And I was like, oh, I could probably fit 16 books in. But wasn't sure because I was going to go through the alphabet that way. But then I decided since I wasn't sure, I'm going through, which sounds weird, A through Z in English order using runes, but knowing that they don't have the same letters. Like they don't really have a C. Sometimes C is associated with the rune for K. They have a rune for NG is its own rune. So I've...
Yeah, I have 2.
It's meant to have a little bit more meaning, but it doesn't. So right now it's AB, it's AB, D, and E.
All right.
By 4. Because they don't really have a C. So it doesn't really have as much meaning as I wish it did, but they're all different.
Yeah, well, that's Latin's fault that we have our crazy C, K, Qs problems in English.
Yes.
We didn't have that problem until like monks speaking Latin infected our language.
Yep.
With Latin nonsense. We used to be a good proper German language. And then the French, you know, then the Frenchified, you know, Norsemen came over and conquered England and made us all speak French for a while and really messed our language up. That's what I think is hilarious. The Normans are Norse conquerors who completely assimilated into French culture, then they conquered England and took it from other Norsemen, like in the Danelaw, as well as, you know, the Saxon kingdom. And that always cracked me up. Like, the Vikings, the Norse got around. They settled, like, there was, like, a Viking kingdom, I think, down on Sicily.
Yeah, well, I don't remember if it's in
Sicily or Sardinia.
Somewhere around there, and I know there were a lot Corsica. Of them were in Constantinople, and they were the, what was it, the vanguard, the, what's the word? I can't think of it, but at the moment. But, yeah, I mean, it's so interesting, like, wherever they settled in large mass, they affected history. Russia is named after the Rus, which was a variant of a hybrid of Nordic. So
yeah, because they went down the Volga, right? They went pretty like
been to Russia, I think, and then kind of was pushed back. And what's really only left is the name Russia.
Yeah, like because Crichton's Eaters of the Dead uses the fact that they went deep into Russia to get his Muslim character up there to like go hang out with Beowulf.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Well, it was really great talking to you, Catherine. Do you want to let our listeners know where they can connect with you on the internet?
Okay. Well, you can. I am on all different social media, but you can check me out on my website, and that's CatherineYBellBooks.com, and I'll spell that out just because my name's a little interesting. It's Catherine, which is spelled KatherineYBell Books.com. So Catherine Weibel. And you can find all my books there and check out my future stories and my blog. But yeah, I hope you enjoy my books if you're interested in Nordic mythology, or check out some of my other series if you just love high fantasy.
Awesome. Well, it was really great talking with you, Catherine.
But lovely talking with you as well.
Yeah, you have yourself a good day.
You too.
This has been Authors in Focus. You can find my fantasy novels on Amazon. Follow news of my writing at my blog, jmd-read.com, and follow me on Twitter at jmdread. You can also join my reader group on Facebook, Fantastical Worlds of the Imagination. You can find more episodes of the podcast at fantasy-focus.com and wherever your favorite podcast is hosted.